Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of literally unearthing the past. This week, battlefields of the past, and in some cases, the distant past. Mark Tveskov is back in the studio this month. Good to see you, Mark.
It's great to be here again.
He's got extensive experience with battlefield digs on our side of the country. Next month, he'll present a paper at the Fields of Conflict Conference held at the Mashantucket Pequot Research Center in Connecticut. And our other guest comes from that center. Kevin McBride is the director of research at the Mashantucket Pequot Research Center and the project director of the Battlefields of the Pequot War Project, started in 2007. Hi, Kevin. Or is that Ashley?
I'm here.
Okay, Ashley Bissonette we have, who's the senior researcher in the Battlefields of the Pequot War Project. Hello, Ashley.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Would you tell us about a little bit about the Mashantucket Pequot Research Center and its establishment?
Sure. So we are the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center. We are the largest tribal museum in the United States, and we focus on really just a lot of different aspects of Native culture. So we are doing the conference here. So a lot of the work that we do is through the battlefield projects and battlefield history, but bringing in a Native perspective. So again, we have the colonial perspectives, but understanding what they ate, how they dressed, how they performed on the battlefield, and really that the Pequots are still here today.
The Pequots had been very far down, though, as I understand it. I mean, essentially disbanded as a tribe and lots of other things that just kind of went wrong for them over the centuries. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, after the Pequot War in 1638, the Connecticut colony said the Pequots are no more. They're extinct. And the fact is, again, they haven't been extinct. Through warfare and, you know, some diplomacy, they were able to reestablish some of their territory here. And they're still alive and well on the reservation.
So the Battlefields of the Pequot War Project sounds pretty straightforward. You were looking for the Battlefields of the Pequot War?
Yes, exactly.
And how extensive was that war? It involved a couple of different sets of actors, including a couple of different tribes, some of them fighting against each other. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. So these wars are very complex. So the Native had their allies, as well as the English had their Native allies with them. And there are a lot of different players in this, and not just the English. I mean, there's some play with the Dutch and some play with the French, especially come King Philip's War, you know, about 30-ish years later. So there's a lot going on these battlefields, and we are finding signatures on how people were situated on the battlefield, and some tribes even have certain signatures. So we find conical points from the, you know, in certain eras from the Narragansetts and the Niantic. So it's been really interesting.
So Mark Tveskov, I mean, since you've done battlefield research primarily in the West, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about what you're looking for, in what ways that archaeology might differ when you're looking at battlefields versus looking at established communities, that sort of thing.
Well, in the larger scope of archaeology, battlefield archaeology is fairly young. It only was in the 80s or so that archaeologists began to turn to battlefields and apply their techniques to trying to understand conflict and war. And Douglas Scott is a famous archaeologist who excavated at the Battle of Little Bighorn. And that very much revolutionized archaeology in a sense, because he was able to forensically unpack where the myths of the battle, like the last stand idea, but also really minute detail, like where different units were stationed on the battlefield by basically a forensic look at the bullet. So it kind of opened up this new avenue for archaeologists to explore. And many archaeologists, like the folks at the Pequot Museum and here in Oregon on our Rogue River War research, have sort of followed suit. And now it's an entire conference.
Well, that's really fascinating, though. I mean, you're saying that at what was considered Custer's last stand, you have evidence from the ground there that there was no such thing as a last stand in the middle of that battle?
Well, there certainly was a last stand because he got wiped out, but in the sense of like that romantic story that it was, you know, there's a mythology around the Battle of Little Bighorn and around the Pequot War and around the Rogue River War. And battlefield archaeology helps us get a more critical perspective on that, to bring in, like Ashley said, indigenous voices, to use the scientific evidence of what's in the ground to understand like what actually happened at these battlefields, not just the mythology given to us by settler mythology or pioneer lore.
So when you're talking, though, about battles in the West, you're talking about Little Bighorn not quite 150 years ago, the Rogue River War maybe 170 years ago. Mm-hmm. So not as far back as, for example, Ashley, you're dealing with. You're talking about a war that was over by 1640, is that right?
So the Pequot War began in 1636, and then our other war that we are working on is King Philip's War, which began in 1675.
All right, so we're talking 400-year-old battle sites. I mean, yeah. And how much trickier is it to deal with a site? And first of all, what kind of areas are you looking at? Because, I mean, the East Coast is so much more developed than our part of the country.
Sure, yeah. We have to work very closely with landowners. A lot of the project areas or the battlefields are developed. So we do have to work very closely with the community. We have to work to make sure there's community buy-in. But we use a lot of metal detectors, and every now and then, if landowners agree, we will do test pits. But we have to be very careful and really rely on the historical record, too. And luckily, we do have some documentation. By King Philip's War, there's definitely more documentation, which does help. But again, that war is a lot more complex.
The King Philip's War, you're saying?
Yes.
What about it makes it so complex?
King Philip's War, there are so many tribes involved, as well as numerous states. So we're looking at Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and they all play, you know, a role in the war and what we're seeing, as well as looking at just so many movements.
It ranged over the entire New England region, all the way up to the St. Lawrence Valley, down to Long Island Sound. It was just a massive in geographic scope.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of aligning and realigning of sides in some of those wars? I mean, you mentioned that. I mean, we looked at the Mohegans and the Narragansetts fighting against the Pequots in the original Pequot War. You mentioned the Nianticks too. I mean, was there a fair amount of was there some side switching as well?
Yes, especially I see a lot of this in King Philip's War through the records. Is, you know, there are some instances that some of the tribes say, "Don't try to Christianize me. You know, I don't want to be part of this." And the English keep pushing, and they said, all right, you know, we're going to war, but also for other reasons. So each tribe, it might depend on, it could be a tributary that they're, you know, they want to switch sides or for trade or because of they don't want to be forced into a religion or a Christian way of life. But also, too, the war, and there's a lot of disease and starvation playing through. So if you're forced to really survive, you might be, you know, pushed one way or the other.
So where are you focusing the digs for the wars that you're trying to research, Ashley? I mean, are you primarily in the state of Connecticut, or as Mark mentioned, because some of these battles range so far and wide, are there lots of other parts of New England you're looking at?
So for the Pequot War, 1636, 1637, most of that is in Connecticut, with the exception of Block Island on Rhode Island. But we haven't done any site work there. So currently we're working in Fairfield, Connecticut, which is the last campaign of the Pequot War, the Fairfield Swamp Fight. We also have done work at Old Saybrook, which is looking at Saybrook Fort. And we've done a lot of work here looking at the Mystic Fort battle as well. So that's in Mystic, Connecticut.
All right, Old Saybrook is at the mouth of the Connecticut River, I know from going to high school in eastern Connecticut. Yes. So I imagine there are some natural forces that help and hinder what you're trying to do, Ashley.
Yes.
Talk about the soil in particular. I remember very clayey soil in parts of Connecticut, and I wonder if that helps or hurts what you're trying to recover.
The biggest challenge for us really is because these places have been so developed, the topsoil and having everything intact is challenging. So we have to, you know, figure out through the highway departments what soil has been used, what kind of soil we're working with. So I would say that's probably the hardest.
Are there often layers of civilization on top of what you're looking for?
Yes, and it's been moved around.
This is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. Ashley Bissonette is a senior researcher in the Battlefields of the Pequot War Project at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center in Connecticut. Mark Tveskov from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology with us once again. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And you had a point you wanted to bring up, Mark?
Yeah, I wanted Ashley to speak about the Mystic Fort project a little bit, because that battle that occurred there is in some ways one of the most important events in American history, and the research that the Pequot Research Center has been doing has been amazing there.
Yeah, so that was our first project. So we learned a lot with that project. You know, we worked on not only, we have historical documents that do explain some of that. Captain John Mason's account, as well as Captain John Underhill's account, as they enclosed the fort there. And it is a turning point because it's the Pequot's largest fort at that time, and the English really do take a number on the fort. But the English really did suffer a lot of casualties, so they were forced to burn it. And with the burning of the fort, we have the loss of 400 Pequot men, women, and children.
Yeah,
so
it was
a very, you know, gruesome event.
It was a very gruesome event, and I think somewhat seminal in American history. I mean, if you look at the, and I studied under Kevin McBride back there in Connecticut and worked at the Mashantucket Reservation as well. And I was always struck, having grown up in Connecticut, how aspects of indigenous experience and the Pequot War in particular were so muted. So for example, the work you're doing in Fairfield, when I was a kid, the only hint of that was a Pequot motel off the highway there in Fairfield. And now you're bringing to earth this entire military campaign that saw the destruction of Pequot sovereignty. And with the Pequot War generally, where you have, at that point, the Pequots were the most powerful political entity in Connecticut, and then the English just burned them out like a nest of wasps, and it set a precedent that reverberated through the work we're doing here in Oregon. Like this idea that Native American or indigenous people could be just exterminated or were expendable.
Mm-hmm. Is Kevin McBride on the line with us now? Is that what I'm seeing? Kevin, you there?
I am.
Okay, Kevin McBride is the Director of Research at the Mashantucket Pequot Research Center and Museum, and the Project Director of the Battlefields of the Pequot War. Actually, you predate Ashley on the project by a year. I mean, has it been a bit of a slog, or does it feel like you're really making some progress?
Oh, I have to say we're making tremendous progress. Yeah, Ashley and I have been working on this, I would say 2007, we documented generally, I don't know, at least 6 or 8 battlefields. And we learned something new all the time. And I think that, you know, those of many of us historians and anthropologists recognize that, you know, conflict is an amazing window on the past. This has so much that is reflected in their social, economic, military, technological aspects of society, worldview, ideology. So we take a much broader view on these projects. Ashley's doing some phenomenally interesting work on sort of health, disease, demographics. And, you know, it's a pretty holistic approach, I would have to say, and it's really paid some dividends.
Let us take a call from one of our listeners. Ann in Eugene is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. This is Underground History with Mark Tveskov, Kevin McBride, and Ashley Bissonette.
Thank you. Well, you know, we hear over and over again about the Nazi Holocaust, about with the Jews in Europe. And yet, the United States was born with two original sins. One was the genocide of the Native American population, and then the other one was slavery. And my question is, how come this genocide gets so glossed over when the descendants of the few that survived the genocide are still suffering in many respects from that original sin? Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate the call. Ashley, you mentioned some of the things that contributed to the massive deaths of Native Americans, like the disease. I mean, how much does this come out in the work, and how much is the term genocide, for that matter, even used?
Through the battlefield projects, I think what we're finding, too, it is a battlefield. It's what people picture is just yes, it was a genocide, but there is a lot of fighting going on between both sides. And the Pequots were, you know, an adversary to be, you know, and they were had a lot of different advantages, and they had a lot of skills on the battlefield. But yes, disease played a huge part. That is a turning point for the war, and King Philip's War, by the spring of 1676. And they are, and both sides are dealing with disease and starvation. And as far as looking at the long-term consequences, there is elements of, say, colonial trauma or historical trauma that we do see really manifested in health disparities.
To this day, you're saying?
Yeah, to this day.
So we established early on that the view of the powers that be in southern New England by the end of these wars just said basically the Pequots had no longer a force. So here again, the whole thing with the winners write the history books. I hate to use such a light term, and it's a relatively heavy discussion. But I mean, did the Pequots even call themselves Pequots? Kevin McBride?
Yes, they did. In fact, if you look at the nomenclature for the names of some of the tribes, you know, early on recorded by the Dutch and others, there's some pretty interesting names given. Some, you know, Pequot means people of the shallow water. I mean, that seemed to be when they were asked, because this appears on the Dutch map of 1614, when they asked the Pequots, what do they call you? They said, well, we're the people of shallow water. So it seems like a direct question and a direct answer. And, you know, in that same context, they're asking the people, what do you call those guys over there? And it was, well, just, it was a generic, the answer was a generic, they're the Easterners. So it's really interesting to pull out these subtleties to see what people are calling themselves and what other people were calling them.
Interesting. So it's often from the perspective of the others, you know, somebody
exactly,
who's got it.
Exactly. Right.
Let's take another call here. We have Don in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and Underground History.
My ancestor fought on the Narragansett side, and they had quite a different view of the Pequots, who were, you know, enslaving tribes and stealing children. You know, I mean, they were really unpopular with a lot of the smaller tribes. My ancestor, who came from a farm called Meriden, had his own little Meriden farm in Connecticut. He also brought over a Welsh longbow, which was kind of notorious and represented a laser cannon to the native people. And it was very, you know, they were successful in the oppression of the Pequots was huge. I just want to get in that side of the thing. From your studies that are, I believe, funded by the casino there, the Pequot Casino. Am I right about that?
That's a good question. Let's
find
it. Go ahead.
They're funded by the tribal government who funds the museum. So we're not funded directly by the by the casino, but most of our funding comes from the National Park Service American Battlefield Protection Program. But I have a question for you. I'm really curious about this longbow reference. What year did this ancestor come over?
Jonathan, I came over with his brother, I believe, in 1630 or something. That he was from the area around Birmingham, and he and his brother came over and made friends with the Narragansetts. They were just, you know, he was known as Strongbow among them because he had this bow that could really. He was a pretty good bowman, is what I'm saying. And he became marshal, and he dealt with the what do you call it, the sachem, the head of the tribe.
Head of the tribe, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating to know this stuff. And by the way, we had an Indian vice president, Charles Curtis, and I'm part Cherokee, so the genocide was unsuccessful. The big mistake the Cherokee made was adopting the white man's ways, I think, because they lost their own culture and they killed all the deer with the new rifles that they had because they could, you know, but I mean.
Don, before you go, have you shared the story of Longbow and Strongbow with the Narragansetts or with the museum in Connecticut?
No, I haven't, but I've discovered this through, studying, looking it up, you know, trying to going to the library and mm-hmm. using the web to find these connections.
Well, they'd probably like to hear from you, so I appreciate you joining us through the exchange.
I mean, it's absolutely fascinating to me, and it's there. I think my theory is there are more Indian genes today than ever, and you know, these Stone Age people, who were wonderful people by all accounts, you know, they were just. It was fascinating the interaction between the European, you know, people and the Native American people. I mean, just imagine what it would have been like. Mm-hmm. And my wife is also part of the Delaware Nation. So, I mean,
okay. Thanks for sharing
the
stories with us.
I think this is a great family reunion. This is what this country is, and I think we should celebrate that.
Okay, a family reunion. Thanks for that. Good to talk to you. We do have just a couple minutes left here to talk about the conference coming up. And Mark Tveskov, your paper is going to be primarily about your finds in Oregon?
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about the battlefield archaeology and conflict archaeology that we've done here in southern Oregon on the Rogue River War, the Battle of Hungry Hill, the Fort Lane, Battle of Big Bend, and other archaeological work we've done.
And we've already talked about the fact that you can find out things about battles that were not necessarily true. I mean, have you found some fairly, aside from finding the site of the Battle of Hungry Hill, have there been some real revelations in what you found there, too, that told a different story than perhaps the history books did?
Yeah, and most importantly for the Battle of Hungry Hill, which was a major defeat for the United States Army, was that how the settlers painted that as not a defeat and covered over their the loss they suffered on that battlefield, including the fact that it was an indigenous woman who led the Native American forces against them. And that was propagandized out of the received history by the people that wrote the history books.
Ashley Bissonnette, have there been some real wow moments in the process of researching the battlefields of the Pequot War?
Yeah. I mean, all the time. There's just, like we were talking about earlier, just looking at or researching the very experiences that people endured during times of conflict. And for me, again, my expertise is really looking at how disease and really poor health impacted the battlefield. So, and of course, whenever we find artifacts, it's always a great thing.
I'm fascinated by the fact that this is not conference is not just about digging on land. There's a dinner speaker I noticed that talks about battlefield wrecks in the ocean. That's Robert Ballard. So this is going to be fun times for archaeologists at the Fields of Conflict Conference at the Mashantucket Pequot Museum and Research Center in eastern Connecticut, where Ashley Bissonnette and Kevin McBride work on the Battlefields of the Pequot War Project. And Kevin is the director of research there. Mark Tveskov from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology in the studio once again for Underground History. Thank you all for joining us today on The Exchange.
Great to be here.